Sie hören eine Veranstaltung der Leipziger Buchmesse. Für die Inhalte ist die Leipziger Buchmesse nicht verantwortlich. Viel Spaß beim Hören.
Hat Naher Osten hinter sich. Früher war es sowas wie der Vordere Orient und Zucks und Tees und Tee und arabische Harems oder so ein Zeug und Bände und man fährt mal nach Tunis und guckt danach sich Bilder von Makka an. Und was es heute ist, brauche ich Ihnen nicht sagen. Da reicht es, wenn Sie einmal die Zeitung aufschlagen. Gestern wurden wieder 30 Schulkinder getötet bei einem Luftangriff. Was dabei natürlich kurz kommt, das ist der Kulturraum. Das Mittelmeer wird umschlossen von Kontinenten, Afrika, Europa und Asien. Ich weiß nicht, ob wir all dem gerecht in dieser einen Stunde, die wir nur haben. Aber wenn wir ein bisschen wollen, eintauchen wollen, dann müssen wir jetzt dringend in See stechen. Ich habe hier vier sehr kompetente Gesprächspartner neben mir sitzen. Vorher eine Frage, wäre es okay, wenn wir auf Englisch sprechen? Oder gibt es welche mit Englisch? Sie können es ruhig sagen, wenn Sie Probleme haben. Ist es okay? Ja? Yeah? It would be better because it would be greater and quicker. We wouldn't lose time with translating. If anybody has a problem, please tell us. Okay?
Maybe the translation.
It was a proposition by Matthias Enau and sent the prize yesterday. We have to do whatever he wants. Yeah. So, okay. Whom have we here? We start to our right. Yassin Al-Haj. He is a Syrian author and journalist, and he wrote 5 Syria or even 6. He's very, very impressive as a journalist. I say myself being a journalist from the Süddeutsche Zeitung, by the way. My name is Alex Rühle. Hallo. He won the Prince Claus Award for his work and lives nowadays as a refugee in Istanbul, where he is with some friends, a cultural center named Hamish. Welcome here on stage. Then we have David Aboulafia to my right. Welcome. He's a British historian. He's teaching medieval history in Cambridge. He in Germany is known for his book about Friedrich II, Friedrich Barbarossa, for his book about the Mediterranean, which is a large, you can read it like a novel. It's about the social, economic relations between the different cultures, the three religions that were here at the shores of the Mediterranean. So that's why we have him here. Then we have Leila Dakhli. Hello. Tunis, who lives in Germany for now in Berlin und so gut Deutsch spricht, dass sie alles versteht, was ich sage. Viele Bücher geschrieben, zuletzt erschienen Histoire du Proche-Orient Contemporain und ist Mitglied in mehreren Redaktionen. Und sie hat gestern eine wunderschöne Laudatio auf Matthias Enau geschrieben, kennen sich nämlich schon viele Jahre. Und eine Rede, in der sie betonte, dass es den Orient, den sie beide damals erfahren hat, 1996 nicht mehr gibt. Darauf werde ich gleich zurückkommen. Zuletzt muss ich aber natürlich noch Matthias Enau vorstellen, der gestern Abend für Kompass den Leipziger Preis zur europäischen Verständigung gewonnen hat. Herzlichen Glückwunsch nochmal.
Danke sehr.
Jetzt wird ja gerade der Buch, ich weiß nicht, ob seine Übersetzer gewonnen haben oder nicht. Nein. Haben nicht gewonnen, aber sie haben trotzdem sehr gut übersetzt. Die Bücher von Enau reichen tief in das hinein, was man früher den Orient nannte. Es geht ganz viel um diese interkulturelle Befruchtung oder diese Wechselbefruchtung und die Missverständnisse und Bereicherungen. Er habe schon Persisch studiert, hat in Iran gelebt, hat im Libanon gelebt und er war 2 Jahre Lehrer, Französischlehrer im syrischen Dorf. Um zurückzukommen auf das, was Sie gesagt haben. What kind of a world has it been at that time when you were a teacher there?
Oh, well, it was, good evening. It was, it was in the south of Syria, in the Druze Mountain. In the Druze Mountains in Sueda. And I was, 25 then? And It was done in the late 90s, and the father, Assad, was still in power. But in this strange island that was the Druze Mountain, I mean, it was an island because it is geographically wise something separated from the Hauran Plain. And it's a dark, black mountain. And so it's a kind of island because the Druze lived there along with Christians, and they lived down in the plains of Hauran. And we hung there that life had been going on like this for centuries, and which is not really true, but almost more or less. And that although they were only 80 miles from Damascus away, they were really far in the south. And I remember that when I used to take the bus from Sueda to Damascus, it was only 1 hour or 1.5 hours. And the feeling that you have to cross many, many frontiers to reach Damascus, that you are not only leaving the mountain, but you are also changing. And the Arabic of the south of the Druze Mountain is really different from Damascus. You were also switching, changing religion, moving clothes. Everything was different in only 100 kilometers. And that was like what life was like at that time.
Und eine Frage daran anknüpfend an Sie beide, an das, was Sie gesagt haben, warum gibt es diese Welt nicht mehr? Was hat sich, natürlich, gerade was Syrien angibt, ist der Krieg und seine Folgen so unvorstellbar grau, inzwischen so lange wie der Zweite Weltkrieg gedauert hat und 500.000 Tote nur in Syrien. Die Frage, warum gibt es diese Welt nicht mehr, denn das bezog sich ja auf die ganze arabische Welt auch. Was hat sich besonders geändert und an Sie beide 20 Jahre später, finden Sie rückblickend, dass man vielleicht diese Katastrophe, das was jetzt wir erleben seit 6 Jahren, auf eine aussehen hätte können?
Well, hello. Sorry for my voice. I just want to say that it's not paradise at this time. It was completely different, not paradise. And Yassin, who is sitting here, knows this very well because he was in prison. And what I just want to say, saying that like everything has changed, is that seeing in front of us this world changing. You were talking about the Druze and the south of Syria. It's also a place where all the big revolts in Syria began. That's the beginning of the 20th century. So it's a place, it's completely connected also to the heart, let's say, of the Syrian people in terms of insurrections and also to the reconnection to like this city of the Syrian people. So at that time, I think somehow we were avoiding the difficulties because the end of the Lebanese war, it was the end of many wars around. So it like this, as I was talking about this in between two wars, just comparing the in betweens we had in Europe and the one which we were living at the time. These periods are in the same time joyful and very like gefährlich. So and then so it's not to say that it was like the golden age, it was not, but it was possible for us to go there and just see and to be with the people and understand what was happening somehow. It is not unfortunately the case for Syria now because we can't the country itself, but we still have connection to the people who were there and who were trying at their own risk to build something else.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be impolite, and I'll get to you in just one more question to this side. Gestern sagte Herr Ennahe im wir haben Syrien aufgegeben. Bei seiner Rede sagte Syrien aufgegeben, es wie einst den Libanon oder Bosnien der Zerstörung und Schmerz überlassen. Und dann bezeichnet er uns Europäer als Zuschauer. Wie meinen Sie das?
Well, what I meant was that we were, and it's true, I am a sad Zuschauer now. I am very sad about Korea, and it has been my day-to-day sad observation since 5 years now, 6 years. And I feel that I belong to a country who has not done anything to stop the war and has, I don't know, it's a strange feeling to like this sad observer of what's happening in Syria. I think that reminds me of what happened in Bosnia. It was closer to Europe, maybe, geographically wise, but and as I was 20 years old and I was watching what was happening in Bosnia, and I felt that I couldn't do anything. My country was not doing anything to stop its war. And I had the feeling that the political powers, the politicians for which I voted, were betraying every confidence I put in them. And that's me now. I mean, I despise François Hollande for his not doing anything. Like, as is, I despised Nicolas Sarkozy for his receiving. And that's, I don't know, that's what I call being a sad observer.
Okay. Yes, Sally, you are a refugee now. You come from Syria, and we'll talk up into you in your former life in Syria with the next question. But now I ask you, you live in Istanbul, and from Europe, how does Europe cope with the refugee crisis, asking you, and with the war of Syria? Are we observers, or how would you call us?
Well, I don't blame the Europeans. I guess that Europe or the governments in Europe betrayed the Syrians. The job of the leaders is to be selfish, to be concerned about their own countries. So if we want to be not selfish, to fight against nation states are, their highest duty is to be selfish and not to care about and to gain a lot for those. So, and I think refugees gives us even more insights, this selfish thing. Refugees all the time demanded or asked to defy themselves, to tell very melodramatic to be believed, and many of them would invent. us to ask those nation states about their legitimacy, because they are now an obstacle towards a more open world. Now, because of the refugee status, the populist tendencies are rising in Europe, and nationalists and right-wing politicians are in the rise. This is because we are not. This is because we are not asking nation states about their legitimacy. I think it is time to think of more open global political horizons.
Very courageous proposition in times of rising nationalism. Get rid with the nation state. Okay, you want to answer something? Or?
I totally agree with that.
Okay.
Yes. But I think it's quite difficult to have another project and to see beyond national states. I am thinking now of a very important German thinker, Ulrich Beck. Ulrich Beck has written about the cosmopolitan point of view and how we could, in politics, enforce a more open cosmopolitan postmodern state, in a way. After the modernity of the nation state, we could invent a new model for, and maybe Europe could be a kind of this kind of new invention, in a way, in the near future. Who knows? But I'm not sure that I'm very optimistic about that, seeing the late political developments in France or in Germany. I think
USA.
I fear that the nation state has still a few years to live.
Yeah. To get back to Mr. Saleh, he's in a way a sad political avant-gardist, since when the naive Western countries still thought that Mr. Assad and his father were leading a multicultural, multi-religious society, and look at them, and even the war photographer Nachtwey made iconographic photos of this fantastic family. He knew already very good that this is all just a lie, and how cynical all this is. He spent 16 years and 14 days in prison for being a Communist Party member, studying medicine in Aleppo when he was caught in 1980, it was, and he was released in 1996 only, and had to live through torture and everything you can imagine. But once you said about this time that it was your second childhood, what did you mean by that?
Well, let me just correct one little piece of information, first of all. I was not arrested because I was a communist. I was arrested because I was disobedient, because the regime had always communists siding with it. I was a communist, actually, yes. But we were communists opposing the regime, and for this I was arrested among many hundreds of my comrades and tortured them. It was an emancipatory experience for me. I was very young. I was less than 20. And our conditions in jail were not of the harshest ones. I mean, the Islamists were dealt with far more brutally than us. So our conditions in the jail were negotiable. You can do something. You can learn something. And after a year and a half in my years, we got books and dictionaries, and I learned my English from there so forgive my pronunciation because I learned English from books, only from books. And this went on for 13 years and a half. So I spent the longest period in one place, in prison, not in any other. I was born in a village, then in Raqqa, then in Aleppo. So my life was fragmented. But in jail, it was continuous for almost 15 years. Then I was taken to, I'm sorry to tell you some facts that should be known about Syria. I was brought to court only after 11 years and 4 months of being arrested. So for 11 years and 4 months, I was in jail. I don't know for how long I will stay. I may be released in a month, in 6 months, in a year, in 5 years. I may die there. We don't know. After 11 years and 4 months, I was taken among many of my comrades to court, and I got a sentence of 15 years. And they felt that they were not satisfied with this. So they took me the last year to Tadmor, which is one of the most horrible places on this planet. Fortunately, I spent only 1 year there. And they felt that they got their whole right from me. And I was released. I was 36 at that time. It was emancipatory because I learned. I changed. It was a new archive for me, new page. And in a way, I am indebted to that period more than my first childhood. I became maybe a bit better equipped for life, for hard life and an impossible country like Syria. So in this meaning, it was a childhood, and I think it is a privilege to have two childhoods, because most of us have only one childhood, and many of us would prefer a different childhood. So when you have two childhoods, it is a very good thing, after all.
We'll get back later to your really very hard life and what you had to go through. But now let me ask Mr. Aboulafia. Hello. as I mentioned, he wrote this book about the Mediterranean, and it's a huge, as I said, it's like a novel, and it's interwoven, and it's written from the point of view of the sea. So it's the sea itself, which is the subject in a way, which interconnects all the cities and all the countries and all the regions and the languages. And when you read it, you can get very, very sad from time to time, because you get this impression that it's so cosmopolitan. These cities like Jaffa or Valencia or Geneva or Venetia, and that all this has been lost. And having read your book, I mean, we are all these clever Schlaubi-Schlümpfe, and we think, we are the globalized ones, we know everything. But having read your book, I have the impression that, and getting back to what he said with, we are just sad, traurige Zuschauer, sad spectators of what's going on. Would you say that the other side of the Mediterranean is today farther away from us than it used to be?
No, I think that is a very important, very fundamental question, because if you read the end of the book, I think the message is that the Mediterranean is now a dead sea in many ways. I mean, it's dead ecologically because the fish are getting smaller and dying and there are fewer of them. But dead also in the sense that the two sides of the Mediterranean, the two main sides, north and south, and I would include in the south the coasts of Syria, Lebanon, Israel, that there's much less interaction between north and south. Actually, and I say this, there's a sort of irony in this, because I wouldn't for a moment wish to defend the colonial regimes, but during the colonial period, of course, there was an enormous amount of interaction from 1830, when the French acquired control of Algeria, between the northern side and the southern side. And it was partly expressed, and this was part of the whole colonial business, of course, in the settlement of vast numbers of not just French, but also Italians and Spaniards in Algeria, Tunisia, and so on. But what this created, nonetheless, it didn't create a common civilization. I mean, clearly, there was a very large indigenous population, Arabs, Berbers, and so on, who were not admitted, for instance, to citizenship in by France, that sort of problem. So don't let me appear to be romanticizing about that period. But it is true, I think, that from the period when the colonial regimes lost their power, so we could really say effectively, I think, from the Second World War, when Italy lost Libya, when Britain lost its influence in Egypt, which was a sort of informal empire, when the French ultimately lost their territories in North Africa. A separation occurred, partly achieved by the intrusion of the Soviet Union, which obviously wanted to make a certain amount of mischief in the Mediterranean. And the second thing that happened, and this does relate to current concerns, is that the European Mediterranean countries, beginning with Italy, began to look northwards, the Italians obviously always liking to think of themselves as potentially a major economic, major industrial power. And as more and more countries acceded to the European Union, they effectively turned their backs on the Mediterranean. And all these attempts that we've had to create sort of Mediterranean agencies, Euromed, etc., involving not just the European Union, all the countries of the European Union, but all the countries around the Mediterranean, get them around the same table to solve some of those ecological problems, for instance, which I've mentioned, have really led to nothing. So I think the Mediterranean is fractured in a way that, frankly, it hasn't been fractured for millennia, in a strange way, that that North and South have become disengaged to a degree that is potentially very alarming.
I would like to ask this question to the three of you, whether you agree with him, and if so, whether it's... he gives one reason, which is the South European countries turned their back to the Mediterranean, looking to Brussels, Strasbourg, and Frankfurt from the 50s on. And would you say this is... can you agree with it, or would you have other reasons for it? And it's still a question for me. We live in this era of globalization, and the European projects, in a way, it worked. It unified us. Meanwhile, I mean, there were things like the what was it called, the Barcelona process, and then Sarkozy made this other initiative. What was it called? I don't find it anymore. Anyway, there were several the Mittelmeer Union, the Union of the Mediterranean, or something like this, and it were just failures. Why was that so?
Can I just talk? I think it's because it concerns, like, we should go back to this question of nation states, because it's all about states having agreements on security, trade, and like these states were sick, all of them, I mean, in terms of what we've lost is not only that, like, the South Europe, or the Europe of the Mediterranean, started to look at Brussels, but also that this idea of the Arab world as something that should be existing, if we can be radical on that, is also some kind of nightmare that, like, was always opposing any kind of real relationship inside the Mediterranean. But then I would also add that there are still many connections between the people in this area. And, of course, we can just see them as something we don't want to see because it's illegal, because it's not, like, in the process of integration. But then what happened with what is called the refugee crisis is also a way to... just open a door to something which was happening since many, many years and is still going on now, I mean, in terms of like people coming and people exchanging, and yet the Mediterranean is also here, is also, I don't know, in Brussels and everywhere in terms of what I think is that, of course, the globalization process, if we see it as a economic, political process, is completely avoiding the Mediterranean space. But in terms of exchanges and knowledge of each other's, at least coming from the knowledge for the people of the south to the north, it's still very vivid and very important in terms of projection and self-projection and recognition of people between themselves.
Yes, what's really fascinating with the Mediterranean Sea is the way that it builds mixity, cosmopolitanism, and destroys it. If we could rewrite the story of the Mediterranean Sea through this thought that, for example, there was Al-Andalus. It was a part of... and the ports of Al-Andalus were part of Jewish, Arabic...
Andalusian.
Andalusian, yes. And it was destroyed. There was this kind of also of cosmopolitanism in maybe in Beirut and in Phoenicia, or later on in the merchant cities of Italy, and it was destroyed too. And maybe what we have seen today is the building of a new kind of mixed city, which will also be shortly destroyed. I mean, maybe Marseille or maybe Istanbul is today the place where this kind of mixed city and mixed culture is being produced through the refugees coming to Istanbul, for example, through... and maybe this will also be destroyed in some time. But so what's fascinating about the Mediterranean Sea is this kind of construction and always reconstruction of something new. I think the last, you mentioned the French power in Algeria, and I think that the last big refugee, Mediterranean refugee movement was from the French, and probably that was the last million and a half, something like that, Pinois coming back to France. Back. No, that's not really the case, but because most of them were born in Algeria. But that was the largest, I think, people's movement in this area before the Syrian crisis.
You have the Greeks and the Turks, and you have so many
others. Yes, in 23, but that was before. Hmm. And so I think that's what's really interesting about this sea, what's fascinating.
No, I agree with what you're saying about the potential for the future. A few years ago, I was in Barcelona, and I was on a panel with Arturo Mas, who was at the time president of Catalonia. And very interestingly, he was talking of his conception of the Catalan nation, which is based largely on language, place of residence. It's not a racial, ethnic concept. And talking about the ways in which he hoped that the large numbers coming across from not just North Africa but sub-Saharan Africa, who have toiled across the Sahara Desert to reach Spain, could also be part of this of a revived city of Barcelona, which could recover something of that multicultural character for which it was famous in the Middle Ages, I mean a very long time ago. So that is the hope for the future. On the other hand, we do have this sort of sense that in the second half of the 20th century, all those cities which did have a multicultural character, the one I always talk about, not that I know it particularly well, is Alexandria, because it was a large city with this extraordinary mixture of that there were Greeks, Italians, Jews, Maltese, Turks, everybody was there. And that, of course, was destroyed largely by Nasser and his policies. But there were so many other examples. And then one thought, well, one place that has preserved this is Beirut. But, of course, then we saw Lebanon descend into civil war. And then perhaps there was that sense, well, Syria has preserved it up to a point because of the significant Christian population, about which admittedly people in the West didn't know very much compared to what they knew about the Christian population in Lebanon. And now we're seeing the end of that. And so there's a sort of sense that these multicultural places have totally vanished. The only one I can really think of is Gibraltar, which is a British colony, of course, but does have actually that multicultural character. But it's a very peculiar place. So I'm not saying it's a model for the rest of the Mediterranean. And this is all very depressing, really.
I've got a perfect Anschlussfrage for Matthias Enar, since he lives in Barcelona for 18 years now, I think. And, by the way, runs a restaurant there just whenever you're in Barcelona.
A Lebanese restaurant.
A Lebanese restaurant from a French writer in Barcelona who lived in Syria in the Jerusalem Mountains for some time. You know. Barcelona wants to take in 150,000 refugees, but the Spanish government says no. So can you explain this? Is it just a cynical calcul of the independentistas?
No, it has nothing to do with the government in Madrid.
Yeah, I know, the government in Madrid who says no. This initiative of saying we want to have 150,000 refugees, is this just a calcul thinking, well, Madrid will say no anyway and then we can blame them? Or is it really that this city has such a multicultural approach that they say, or that they are so open to say, we want to have 150,000 refugees, which in these times is very impressive?
The civil society was really prepared for that. Everything was prepared to receive those refugees. There are many homes were prepared for that, turned into refugees, kind of refugee flats. There are many civil rights activists who worked and networked for this to be ready, to find job opportunities, possibilities to live, really live in Barcelona. And that was really the city of Barcelona. And so, as it was a municipal and very local initiative, it had no real international political power. So they couldn't, of course, not give visas, not give refugee status to no one. So it failed, because Madrid said no. And do you know how many refugees there are now in Spain, officially? That's official.
24?
A little more.
26?
1,000. Yes. In all Spain.
Well, speaking about cosmopolitan hubs and intercultural melting pots, Barcelona is one place, Istanbul is another one, or was another one. You live there now for 3 years, I think. How did it change in this time that you lived there?
Well, I want to emphasize one one factor that I feel a bit ignored in David's approach to the Mediterranean. I share his dystopic vision of the future, of the present situation of the Mediterranean. It's almost a dead sea, because of politics, not culture, not because multiculturalism is in a bad situation in our side of the sea. It is, we should, I think, give more importance to the political changes and political situation in that region. We've talking, David and me, this morning, and that the Middle East is the region, the most internationalized region in the world, that witnessed one big war every 10 years, and with losses, with huge losses in human lives and in resources. So that's what made this region, this is at least one factor that made this region a political desert, and people are fleeing from Syria because they were killed, they were oppressed, they were bombed. Bombs are falling over their heads. They were killed with chemical weapons. And because we have a dynasty ruling the country for half a century, now we cannot speak about the Mediterranean, and Syria is a Mediterranean country. Without this, we cannot talk about it. Without the Israeli-Arab struggle, without, we have a whole population, Palestinians, without state, without being accepted as equal to others. We have a coup in Egypt that was supported by the global powers, Sisi coup in Egypt. And we have an older coup in Algeria that was also supported. So this is it. I think we cannot ignore these issues. Now, what I'm afraid about Turkey is that the democratic potential that was ascending since the election of the AKP for the first time in 2003 is at its lowest level now. The authoritarian ambitions of Mr. Erdogan are rising, though at the same time, I have to say, I am very skeptical about the demonizing of Erdogan in Europe, I find, and in the West. They are obsessed with the and there's sort of personification of a political and of social and economic problem. But it's true that he's becoming more and more authoritarian, more and more rigid, and there's a lot of tension in Turkey. I feel that this is felt in Istanbul. When I came 3 years ago, 3 years and a half ago, I enjoyed seeing people and mingling with people. I feel that they are more reserved now, and the level of anger, of rage, is rising. So I'm not very happy with this. I'm a refugee myself, and the prospect of being a refugee for the second time is bleak for me. I just wish that, and this is part of the destiny of the Mediterranean, I just wish that the situation will not go on. And maybe it is not only Turkey which is responsible about this. Europe can help. I think they've been not helping. What happened in the Netherlands only 2 weeks ago was not very helpful. And I have some personal also experiences about the way some European political bodies are dealing with Turkey. This is not very promising, I'm afraid to say.
I'm a bit in despair because we are running out of time, but this was clear with such a large subject. So I have to choose from my three or four papers here two last questions. One thing that interests me myself day and night at the moment is why is it the hell, where does it come from, this enormous strength of nationalism, this and this reclusiveness of the identitarian. You were just proposing to get rid with the nation state. I mean, yeah, why not? But how can you convince someone like Donald Trump about it? But let's not talk about Trump, but about this, that everywhere, wherever you look, France, Germany, but also the Arab countries, you have this rebirth of a very strong Iron nationalism. Can you explain it to me?
I think it's not always true. I'm going to speak a little bit about what is happening in my country, Tunisia. I mean, my feeling is that like when people get involved in politics, they are more, they are less obsessed by nationalist views and like this kind of narrowness. And I would say also that like if you look at what is really concretely happening on the local level in many places, it's true that like people are voting for populists and people are voting for closeness and so on, but like so many people are not voting, first of all. So many people are doing things and not like acting politically and not only delegating their vote to politicians. Mm-hmm. which means that we have like a huge difference between a civil society which is calling for more equality, for more mixity, and not only calling but just acting, like mixity in terms of like racial or inter-ethnic marriages, in terms of, like we're talking about France. France is the country where probably Marine Le Pen will be the first at the next voting election. But it's also the place in Europe where you have the more, the biggest numbers of mixed marriages, of mixed children like me. In terms of, if you look at the society, it's like, completely, it's more diverse than like Germany, for example. Of course, that the democratic culture in Germany is clearer, is more present in terms of like political acts in the politicians' acts and Bewegung, like comportment. I'm just mixing Bewegungen in my hands. Sorry. So it's not, we are just saying that we should get rid of the nation states. It's also a way to look at the situation. It's not like I'm only saying no, it's not that I'm naive, it's just that it's also reality. It's also reality that people are now in this kind of world too. Like not only the richest who are just taking place.
When you say this, are you talking especially about Tunisia, or is it the same for Morocco, Egypt and the other countries and we just don't see it?
No, I was talking about Tunisia because it's a place where you still can act politically for a change in this moment.
Is it among all these Arab Spring countries a positive exception, you would say?
Of course I would say so, but not only because we have bad politicians now in Tunisia. No, really, just like in many countries. It's not that this revolution gave birth to some kind of really nice government. It's not about government. This government is old and like corrupt and is really, really bad. I mean, but the people are still, and they still work.
Does this mean there's a strengthening of civil society?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah,
oh, wonderful.
I don't like the expression civil society, but people
Why
are
not?
In charge.
What?
Because it's still
so
very,
abstract,
very NGO kind of things. It's more like, you know.
Okay.
Well, since we speak about nationalism, just one to somewhere totally different. Since we have someone here who's a pro-Brexiteer. Mr. Aboulafia is chairman of the organization Historians for Britain, and he was for the Brexit.
You want an explanation?
Yes!
Yes, yes. Well, you say active.
Are you still
active
for
we're
the
not,
Brexit?
We're not particularly active at the moment because referendum has happened. Let me go back to the beginning of this, of academic historians who were approached by an organization called Business for Britain. And the motto of Business for Britain was change or go. So what they were arguing for were two things, very important two things. One was that Britain's relationship with the rest of the European Union had to change. And of course, that's what Mr. Cameron went off Brussels to negotiate. And the second thing was that the European had to change. And one thing, for instance, that I think colleagues felt very strongly about was the so-called democratic deficit, the fact that Kirk can make all these pronouncements when he's sober, when he's not sober. He has never been democratically elected to do. And the fact that the legal system of Britain, common law system, is entwined now with European legislation imposed from Brussels. So there were issues of this sort that people strongly about, but which could have been resolved by a willing at the other end in Brussels. Cameron came back with proposals which many people thought were not particularly, wouldn't really transform the situation. So, to make a choice, and some of us, not all of us, moved, we thought, a certain degree of reluctance, that we would have to vote against. Now, Organisations for Britain, in fact, then transmuted itself into the Vote Leave campaign, which was, I should point out, the moderate campaign. It was not UKIP. They had a more strident campaign against Europe. So then, you know, if we listen to Boris Johnson, he was saying, well, let's say we win the referendum, let's also perhaps then give Europe the chance to come back with better terms. But the way things worked out, that was unrealistic. So we find ourselves in this situation where we are ready to leave the European, but not, of course, to leave Europe. And that's a very important consideration. That's the first consideration. The second consideration, which is of a totally different order, is discussing all these issues, and particularly the issue of the sovereignty of Parliament, which to me is a very important issue. The level of discourse is absolutely abysmal on both sides. So when Remainers say the Leavers were constantly telling lies, I say, but Remainers were constantly telling lies, led by George Osborne, the Chancellor of the Exchequer. So, I mean, no glory attaches either side, but we, a group of academics, we were trying to bring a certain amount of reasoned debate to this. So our contacts were mainly with newspapers up to a point, though they usually miss what people are saying, some politicians, but trying to have right across the board from Labour to Conservative and really make this into a serious debate about Britain stands in relation to Europe. The final point I'd like to make is we talk about nationalism in a British context. We have to be aware Britain is actually four nations, and obviously many of us want to keep this union together, but that is that particular flavour to the sense of British, which is much more bound up with what I would call patriotism than with nationalism. I don't think the word national works in a British context, and all the more so because one sees nowadays in London, other major cities, the city has certainly become very multicultural, and the relationship in the old sort of ancestrally British population and the people of varied origin has become a very good one by and large. There's, I mean, overt racism, a little bit of it after the referendum, horrific as it was, but actually at a very low level compared to some of our European neighbours, particularly actually France.
Well, now we should start the discussion. Three people saying get rich, they'd one saying, well, Britain has to be Britain again without Europe. That would be funny. The bad news is we have to stop here. All my other questions concerning your history, concerning Europe and the, well, we have to leave it here, but the good news is, due to the Ute Konowitz tonight at 9 o'clock, the same people will be there, except it will be Katrin, but the four of them will be there at the Ute Konowitz. It will be more about the cultural relationships, not so much social, political thing. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you for the Allianz Kulturstiftung. Thanks for your patience.
Danke fürs Zuhören. Wir sehen uns auf der nächsten Leipziger Buchmesse.